Hey guys, this is Hunter Levine, and thank you for listening to the Captain's Collective podcast, brought to you by Skinny Water Culture, Hell's Bay Boatworks, and Orvis Fly Fishing. Charleston is a beautiful southern city filled with good food, hospitable people, culture, and of course, great fishing. Known well for its flood tides, where sleek skiffs head out in search of redfish cruising otherwise inaccessible spartina grass, Charleston is a paradise that has earned its attention in writings, photography, paintings, like our most recent episode with artist and beloved Charlestonian, Paul Puckett. Today's guest, Captain Jake Ellington, sat down with me to discuss his waters and to help me understand the bigger picture of his fishery. We discuss flats and bay boat fishing, how to help families engage in the outdoors, the significance of bait shops and fly shops when it comes to raising up anglers, and of course, some food and fishing tips. These are the types of interviews that keep me excited to make new friends and visit new places. If you're enjoying this podcast, please help out by sharing it with friends, following us on social media, and leaving a review on iTunes. If you want to go above and beyond and be a real friend, grab some of our stickers at captainscollective.com. Thanks for your support. We hope that you enjoy. This is the Captain's Collective.
He's out there.
I'll say it's anything you choose, I think it picks you, you know? It's genetic.
Let everything else stop in the world and just be quiet. And it's amazing where your mind goes at that point and where it doesn't go. And sometimes just that quiet space is what we need, and especially in this day and age.
If you have a fly rod in your hand, it's this tool that takes you to beautiful places. You meet hopefully wonderful people, and it's just this cherry on top of this outdoor adventure.
When the fish is coming, that shot within a shot, that timer start. Beep, 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 beep,
beep. No one else knew anything anyway, and you're just definitely making it up as you're going along. But
so what Grandpa and Dad would tell me is like, all right, where's an old big trout laying out there? Where's his shaving cream on the water? Where's he been shaving this morning? I have to look for his shaving cream on the water, and that's where he's going to be.
Hey, Jake, thanks so much for sitting down with us and hanging out on the podcast. Recently, I was talking with Paul Puckett, and he pointed me your direction, and I'm really looking forward to the opportunity to talk about a fishery that I've always wanted to fish and yet haven't got a chance to, Charleston, and just all the great things that you guys have going on over there. But before we get into that, I'd love to hear about how you first got into fishing and how you eventually got into guiding.
Yeah, Hunter, man, good talking to you, and thanks for having me on. Got into fly fishing and generally fishing since I was like 10 or 12 and taught myself how to cast and fly, tie flies and kind of like the, you know, cliche generic stuff. But I also have a strong background in saltwater fly fishing or saltwater fishing, I guess. you know, like back in the day in the 90s, the kingfish tournaments and stuff in Florida, like what you're used to. My dad was all into that stuff. And then we spent a lot of time fly fishing in North Carolina and North Georgia. And the two things just kind of came together and I ended up in Charleston. And that's really kind of how I ended up where I am now.
Yeah. When for you did you kind of make that switch from, so kingfishing is, it's awesome. I mean, it's a really, but it's very different from flats fishing and push pulling around in a flood tide. When did you first realize that you wanted to be more of an inshore guide than an offshore guide?
You know, the offshore stuff was always like what we did. And then I remember back and we had a place in like Amelia Island, St. Augustine. We spent a lot of summers that area, San Fernandino, Marina and all that. And when it was too windy to go kingfishing, you would go redfishing. And it was kind of like something that people didn't do then. And when those guys down there realized I could throw a fly rod and I was 13 or 14 years old, they were kind of like, oh, wow, let me show you, you know, there's Jack Crevalle around, there's redfish around, there's sea trout. Like, you can throw a fly rod, which at the time not many people could, especially not a 13 or 14 year old. And, you know, it was just, that was when I kind of got introduced to it. And, yeah, it was like they almost thought it was just like, something cool.
Yeah. Did you have many friends fly fishing at that age? I mean,
No, not at all.
When a lot of us were 13, we were bass fishing, you know,
all my friends, I grew up in Atlanta and I spent a lot of my time in Florida, but in Atlanta, all my bass fishing buddies, which is all we did was bass fish, were just throwing regular tackle and I was always just throwing the fly rod. And it was just to me, that was just what I did. And they just kind of did their thing and that was my thing. And there just weren't a lot of people doing it at the time, but it was just kind of what I enjoyed and what I did.
Did you do anything career-wise before you got into guiding?
Yeah. Well, I got my creds when I was, right out of college. So like 21, I guess it was like 2009, 2008. And, I've guided and then done other things and then come back to guiding and then done part-time guiding. And then the last like 5 years has been full-time, but it's been like a on and off thing. It just kind of depends on the support system you have around you at the time. Mm-hmm. And the last 5 years I've been super lucky to have a great support system and, been lucky to be able to dedicate myself to it the way I wanted to.
Yeah. And I'd love for you just to share, cause I think I've had several guests recently have a setup similar to this, but you know, you have a bay boat and you have a flat skiff. And I'd love just to hear a talk through on kind of how you structure your business and what different things you target and experiences that you offer.
Yeah, man. So when I had my ideal guide set up in my mind, one of my very best friends in the whole world, Scott Davis, had the Low Country Fly Shop, which was a super cool fly shop up here. It was great. The area really needed it. He was in business for like 7 or 8 years. And I guided for him kind of part-time to full-time and just had the one-man pulling skiffs. And then when his business shut down, it was a bit of a bummer. I kind of realized at that point I either needed to, you know, shit or get off the pot, I guess. And that was when I picked up a Hell's Bay. And I had a 21 Jones Brothers, actually, at the time, a center console. And that boat was awesome. But the bay boat and the flats boat for here in Charleston give you such versatility because we can go offshore and find those big redfish that are offshore that are spawning, or cobia or amberjack or, you know, false albacore, that kind of stuff. Like, you know, we have a pretty serious offshore fisher here that people can access. And then obviously you need the poling skiff to do the inshore stuff. So it's good. And then also, you know, like we'd all like to just be fly fishing guides, but to carry yourself through the year and pay all the bills and, you know, do everything, you need to take those families through the marina. I guide out of Isle of Palms Marina, which is a very you know, there's like a big resort right next to it, Wild Dunes, and it's a big, you know, beach town. And, you know, you got to be able to pay the bills. So getting the bay boat and the flats boat at the same time kind of helps you get those bait trips to pay the bills. And I grew up bait fishing, you know, like I said, so it wasn't too much of a, I've had to relearn how to bait fish after fly fishing for so long. It was kind of embarrassing almost to go back and be like, how is it that I can go have like a turbo, like awesome day on the fly, but then I go out with live shrimp and I'm not confident.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that was something that I want to talk about too, because I saw a project you did where I thought this was pretty awesome. I do a lot of live bait fishing too, and I enjoy it. There's something nostalgic to me. There's something enjoyable about the process of catching bait. I enjoy it. Some fly guides, I know that they're, you know, anti, that's fine. That's their agenda or whatever, but you know, you did something I thought was really cool, and you built like actual bait tanks at your house, and it seemed like a serious setup. Could you tell us about kind of how you built those tanks and how you used that for your business?
Yeah. So first I wanted to say on that, like, kind of just that line, I know a lot of fly fishermen in saltwater who think that they're, you know, and they're great fly fishermen, but in my mind, you need to be able to do all of it. Like, you know, you right when I said kingfishing, you're like, oh yeah, man, kingfishing is awesome. And you know, the more that you can go kingfishing or catch fish on bait or understand the whole ecosystem, the way that the bait moves, the way everything moves. So I think, like, if you can catch fish on bait, if you can catch fish on bottom, on top, on artificials, on fly, it makes you like a better guide.
Absolutely.
And I tell my fly fishing buddies that, and they're like, you know, they just look at me like, you know, for the guys who are like only fly, you know, that's fine if they're anglers, but if they're guides, you need to know the whole ecosystem. And, but yeah, so the bait tanks kind of came, I had a little bit of experience taking care of saltwater fish tanks just throughout my life. So I understood the filtration mechanism, and I had the opportunity to get my hands on some really big, plastic. They actually shipped fish in Alaska in these things. So they're like 150 gallons each. I put three of them up together to a filtration system. And I got the left one set up for mud minnows, the right one set up for shrimp. So it's a little more oxidized, and I can actually keep it colder than the other ones, because I can get the return pump directly to it. And I can put frozen 1 gallon bottles of water into the filtration system and shoot cold water into it. And then the right one's just kind of like catch all. We can put blue crabs or whatever. But yeah, it was just, you know, a lot of times here we can't always get the best live bait. It's not like Florida, where I remember growing up and there was a guy that had live shrimp like at every single marina. And here it's not like that. We're at the very top of those guys get those shrimp in Florida, and we're at the very top of their you know, drive, or I guess, you know, logistics, you know, and by the time they get here, all the shrimp are small and they're hot. And, you know, it's like, if you want live shrimp in South Carolina, you got to go get it yourself. And so I wanted a way to, for my customers, especially in the fall where trout season goes on, but I just wanted a way for my customers and me to always have live bait no matter what.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was a cool system. It's, my wife like hated the project because I was underneath the house for, I think, like 2 or 3 weeks straight, but it ended up being a full success.
How long? Yeah, so it took you like 3 weeks. I mean, how? I'll include some pictures in the blog post so that people can see this. But like, how big of a commitment financially, and how big of a commitment time wise is it for somebody who wants to set up their own live bait tanks?
Man, if you want to learn about that stuff, go look at like people and forums online who take care of fish. You know, like saltwater aquariums. So mine was like very easy because I found a guy who had these big rubber, not Rubbermaid, they're much nicer than that, but I was able just to like scan Craigslist forever. Like I knew exactly what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I wasn't going to spend, I think I spent $200 on all of it. Where if you wanted to, like if I was going to go buy like four of those things set up, like glass aquariums, like you could spend like $2,000 or $3,000. But I knew exactly what I wanted, and I kind of had an eye out for it. And I mean, you know, the more sweat equity you put into it, I had to redo every single seal. You know, I think I have three big tanks, and what I did was I bought seven from him at $50 each, so $350. Knowing that four of them would leak.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of like played my odds. So when you're buying like used things from people, like I knew I wanted a 3-tank setup, so I bought 7.
Yeah.
So you just have to kind of, anytime you're doing the fish tank stuff, it's you can like just count on Murphy's Law.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. But
just,
I feel
just like boats.
I feel like it's a really convenient setup, especially when, and I know this is the case for us, if you're running a live bait trip, right, and maybe you don't have another trip for 2 or 3 days and you're looking in the bait well and you're like, man, I have a bunch of good bait here. And, you know, to be able to go home and to transfer that bait into a big holding tank, I think is, and we'll sometimes use like holding pins out in the water here.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest with you. I mean, you want to talk about Murphy's Law. I mean, these guys who are stealing people's traps are, it's just, we lost 6 different types of traps this year so far.
Oh yeah.
From holding pins to crab traps to bait traps. And, you know, I would feel a lot better with just something in my garage. And so that's definitely, I think, a cool project. How long, I mean, on a mud minnow or a shrimp, how long can you expect to keep it in there if you're running the tank well?
So like the mud minnows will live there forever. We always joke that, you know, you could keep a mud minnow alive in a mud puddle in a parking lot of the marina overnight if you needed to. The shrimp are different because they need to stay cold. They like cold water and they need oxygen. So the shrimp, also shrimps don't like phosphates. Invertebrates in general don't like phosphates, which is in our drinking water. So unless you want to grab like a really badass water filter system to fill up your 300 gallon, you know, bait well, which I didn't. They only got about 4 or 5 days in there.
Okay.
But you know, like
if you do it right, what do you get? Like if you set it up right, what are you looking at?
So right, I mean, you can keep mullet, croaker, blue crabs, and the mud minnows forever. I mean, you can keep them in there forever. But the shrimp. The shrimp don't like the phosphates in the water. So there's like type of phosphates removers you can use. But I mean, I don't really like to keep my shrimp in there much longer than like 4 or 5 days before they start getting a little sluggish. And it also, you can't overcrowd the shrimp as much as you can. You can add oxygen systems, which I'm sure you've seen those on like live wells in the boats.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the oxygen systems will add a little bit, but I try to keep the shrimp in there. I mean, I've probably kept shrimp in that in the fall, like, I don't know, a month and a half.
Wow.
And, but, you know, every time you have to keep them in there, what you don't want to do is keep them there too long, because if you keep them there for a long time, you have to feed them. And every time you feed them, you're adding nutrients to the system, which turns into waste, which is something you have to remove through the system. So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's like science. My wife calls it the science experiment.
my kids would love it. I'm sure kids love it.
Yeah. We have kids around the same age, and my 3-year-old daughter loves going to touch the fish. She spends a lot of time down there manhandling them.
Yeah, that probably takes a couple of days off the life expectancy, but
yeah. Luckily, mud minnows, it's like you're not too worried about it.
Yeah, well, it's better than being in the boat with sunscreen on. We have a little thing on the boat that says no hands in the live well, because people, you know, they'll like lather up in sunscreen, stick their hand in there, and kill off half the bait. You know,
right.
So it's like you gotta teach your. We usually put them in a little bucket for her to play with, because, you know, we figure we'll just sacrifice those three, you know, those poor three, you know, white baits to entertain her. But you know, you had mentioned something earlier. I thought was. I talked to Billy Rotney, who's down in Mosquito Lagoon, and he's got a bay boat and he's got a flats boat, and he brought up similar points. And I do feel like there's a lot that you can learn about just certain species, like particular redfish, where all of a sudden you can fish them really, really effectively almost year round. And that allows you to go to some deeper water that just, I mean, wouldn't make any sense with a fly. You know, could you tell me about like what do you like for you with redfish? Because I know that's a species you love. Like, what's the cycle look like for you throughout the year?
Yeah, so compared to the fly, to the conventional tackle, like I said, I got it for the fly shop and was pretty much, there was probably like 3 years there where I didn't have a spinning rod on the boat. I also ran that boat without a depth finder, and that was on purpose. Because we were only fishing shallow. Like, it didn't matter. And when I got back to the full bait fishing, I like had to teach myself how to catch redfish again in more than 2 feet of water. And what I realized was that there's a lot more fish out there than I you know, was aware of, or that than I was targeting. And then that, you can take that and, you know, we have a full 6 foot tide cycle here. So we have low tide. And then, you know, we have up to our flood tides, which are 7 feet tall. And all these mid water column fish that I wasn't targeting before, that I was targeting it once I started bait fishing and stuff like that, they'll tell you where everybody else is. So, you know, a lot of these fish coming up on the flats, and a lot of these fish that are up in the grass flats, or, you know, that you can visually sight fish, they're just kind of like outliers of big, big groups of fish. And, you know, when especially when you start getting into trying to target the bigger fish, you get these shots where people will say, well, you know, I'll only see a fish over 35 inches in South Carolina like every once in a while. And it's like, well, they're here all the time. It's just they're in deep water. So if you can find those big fish, then you can find out where you have the best chance of sight fishing them.
Yeah.
So it helps your chance to fly fish them. It helps your chance to, you know, all that. But
yeah. And I think that makes total sense. And then another thing, you know, you had mentioned with the bigger boats taking families out. And I always think that that's like a really rewarding thing to do. I love to take my family out. It becomes an easier experience for them to be able to catch fish. And I'm sure for you that you've experienced the same thing. I mean, I love to just try to expose my oldest to just different environments. Could you talk to me too, just about how do you try to, when you have a family on the boat, how does that look different than maybe if you have a hardcore fly fishing client who they want to push pull, they want to see them in the flood, they want to, you know, and I get that. It's beautiful. It's incredible. But what does it look like to take a family out for you? What do you feel like is the most effective trip?
Yeah, man, you just have to like change your mindset, because when you are on that guy who, you know, is a fly fisherman in quotation marks, or real serious about it, you know, you have to be on your game. And but then when you take a family out, you're not an entertainer, but you're there to give them the best experience they can have. So you have to kind of just, you know, I deal with this with my 12-year-old stepson all the time. There'll be a awesome redfish bite or a big tarpon bite or something that we could go, and I know that he would rather catch 4 or 5 sharks, and that would make him happier, where it would make me happier to go sit for these tarpon and see 4 roll and maybe hook one, you know. But he would, if we caught 5 sharks, he would just have like the best day of his life. So when you have the families, you just have to, you know, do what's best for them and put your ego at the door. And, you know, you might not come back to the dock with a tarpon release or a big redfish or, you know, whatever, but, you know, if they want to go catch 5 bonnet heads and that makes them super happy, then you did your job better than if you had done the other decision. So you just have to read the situation and, you know, at that point, you're just, you know, you're providing them a good experience. And that's something that I was guilty of when I first was younger. I would say, well, there's a tarpon bite, you know, let's go. It's a 25 or 30 minute extra boat ride that they didn't want to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, we didn't catch any fish. We saw one tarpon roll and they were like, what? When we could have, you know, caught 20 sharks and 10, 15 redfish right by the 10 minutes from the marina, they would have had the best day of their life. So,
yeah. And I think that, and I have a lot of friends who have different philosophies, and I really just feel like it's your business. You can build it the way you want. If you just want to do, you know, shallow water fly fishing, then you can make that decision to to really build your business around that. But I agree with you that there is something gratifying, and I do think it's more, for many people in many fisheries, just more lucrative, especially if you want to stay in your hometown, you know, to be able to do multiple types of experiences, be able to take 3 to 4 people out if that's what you need to do. And to me, like, I think there's certain species that, you know, we have great mangrove snapper fishing down here, and I love to do that. It's a really fun thing to do every once in a while. It's not something I would want to do every day, but the diversity, I think, is also just enjoyable. So I definitely understand why somebody would want to build a business just around one type of fishing, and I respect that, and I've interviewed a lot of people who have done that. But I agree too that sometimes guys who have more holistic businesses don't always get the respect they need for the fact that they've really figured out how to craft this great experience for what the customer wants, you know, and focus on them. So I think that's great. You know, taking the family out, I think, is an incredible privilege and something that's really important. I'm reading a book right now called The Last Child in the Woods. It's for anybody who's interested in just thinking about raising children in the outdoors and the effects that technology can have on them that are negative. And in the book, he talks about nature deficit disorder, but he talks about just the benefits of being able to go out. And he talks about a story of how he used to climb an orange tree and how throughout his whole life, he would just think of that moment and it would bring him peace, and how even those small things like going on walks, climbing trees, playing in rivers and on the beach, how those things impact you over your lifetime and not just in the moment. And I know that you love to take your kids outside and get them exposed to fishing and get them exposed to the ecosystem. Tell us about some of the cool things you do, because I've seen lots of camping and shark's teeth and wanted to hear more about that.
Yeah, man. So funny you talk about a book. So my father-in-law, talking about children and being outside, always, you know, kind of equated it to training up hunting dogs and labs. Mm-hmm. Like you never want to leave them tired or unhappy. So we do everything, you know, we do everything small and not tiring. So we want to keep them happy. So like the shark's tooth hunting is great because you can go find, you know, obviously you do it beforehand, but you go find a shell bank or something that has some strata of black fossilized material, you know, material mm-hmm. that's going to be in the 10,000 fossilized range. And then you just sit on that bank, you know, in an hour, we'll find 20 or 30 shark's teeth.
Wow.
Or, you know, for the little kids, we just go for rides. But what you don't want to do is ever tire them out, mm-hmm. make them unhappy, make them hungry. Because then they're going to, you know, equate the boat, equate the fishing, equate all the things that you love with, you know, things that they don't want to do.
Yeah. You want to leave them happy. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what you want to leave them happy. And, you know, the lesson ends when they're, you know, not happy anymore. Mm. Yeah, I mean the 12-year-old, you know, James is the man. He's done a lot of cool fishing things, but there can be an awesome huge redfish bite going on, or, you know, I know that there's sick tarpon bites right offshore, but it's gonna be a bumpy ride. And if he just says, I want to catch some sharks, I'll say, yeah, man, let's go catch some sharks. Mm-hmm. Because it's just kind of like customers, like if you want it to keep them happy and keep them coming back, you just got to keep making them happy. And it's not about, you know, what you want, it's about what they want. And yeah, it's fun to have them on the boat. I think you and I were joking about how both our daughters want pink boats.
Yeah.
So I think maybe my next boat might have to be pink.
You gotta be known for something. But you know what? I mean, think about that. It's a compliment when you're a fishing guide and your kid doesn't think of fishing as something that pulls their dad away and they hate. And, you know, it's like, no, this is something I want to be a part of. I want to have a boat. To me, that's a good sign. And
yeah,
you know, I think that a lot of us are wired where we just kind of, you know, we get in the zone and we really want to see success. We want to catch a certain number of fish, a certain species of fish, and we can just forget the kid on the boat and how we're trying to bring them out to expose them to these things and get them these opportunities. And I think that's a great point, taking them out, you know, to hunt shark's teeth after a big tide, or, you know, just taking them on a boat ride. And you did a camping trip too. I wanted to hear about that because I haven't done that yet. And I think that would be a really fun family trip.
Yeah, man, the camping trip is super cool. So we just did that with the 12-year-old. The little ones really aren't ready for it yet. We did it with one of his buddies, and his buddy's dad, I'm not really sure, knew I was a fishing guide.
Mm-hmm.
So he was kind of like, whoa. When we, on the way to the spot, we caught like, you know, 20 fish. Mm-hmm. And just kind of had a good time. But, you know, it was fun to see them. Out here it's called Capers Island. We have our barrier islands. You know, the kids built a big couch, or a big couch out of sand.
Mm.
And, you know, they were just constantly in the marsh. And they didn't really even care about fishing because we caught a lot of fish on the way there. But, yeah, the being able to camp in the marsh is cool.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be careful, at least in our part of the country, in the middle of the summer, because it's too hot and mm-hmm. there's a lot of bugs.
Mm-hmm.
So really, you have to get away from the bugs. The bugs are the ones that will really, really ruin you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I watch people every day that I leave the marina. I see people, it's a very common thing for kayakers to do, which I don't really understand, because kayakers can't take that much stuff. So it's just kind of like, but I think anyone who must be kayaking must just want the punishment anyway.
Yeah. They're like Survivor Man or whatever the dude's name is.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just use a motor and a boat and take all the stuff you want. But they go in the middle of the summer. So, you know, the fall is just an amazing time. The big bull redfish that are breeding are coming down the coast. You can catch these big, big, big redfish right off the beach. You can camp out there and pretty much just plan on having sand in every single thing that you can possibly bring if you ever camp on a beach. So we spend a lot of time in the western North Carolina mountains, where we have two fly shops, the Brookings fly shops. And we have two different sets of camping gear, like one set of camping gear to go camp on the Barrier Islands, because those are covered in sand, like where you can't ever get it out, and then our regular camping gear. But you'll get sand in places that you didn't know sand could get.
That's why I currently, with an infant and 4-year-old, going to the beach is like a 2-trip thing for me, which is my limit. You know, anything else and we're not bringing it in. Sand everywhere, you got to clean everything. You know, I like my feet. The thing I enjoy more than sand between my toes is fiberglass under my feet. I like fiberglass, you know. And
I'd much rather be on the boat than on the beach.
And you guys like build fires and stuff. What are a couple little things that you guys try to incorporate into that, other than just catching the migratory bull reds?
You bring a lot of firewood. We get permits through the SCDNR. For us, it's like good food. You know, lots of good food.
What's good camp food? Like, what we talking beanie weenies here? Or are we talking about filet mignons?
No. So the last two times that we've done it, one of my stepson's father is a chef. So he's brought like, you know, he'll be like, you bring the shrimp. So I'll go deep hole shrimp because it's the fall. So deep holing shrimp in our harbor. Do you guys use those, the taped cast nets in Florida?
Yeah, some people do. You know, I was going to ask you about that because I personally don't have a shrimp net. But yeah, I know people
do. So we're really into the deep hole shrimping thing. And we do it year round here because we have, you know, the harbors right here. It's all deep. But yeah, so he was like, yeah, you bring the shrimp and I'll bring the ribeyes. And so, and then the kids don't really care. You know, honestly, I bring them Chick-fil-A sandwiches enough for 2 days.
You like because, go through the drive-thru, you're like, I'll have 12 Chick-fil-A sandwiches.
Yeah, no joke. It's like, it's tricks that I learned when I used to work on big sport fisher boats. Would be like, the owner of the sport fisher boat would always say, you know, man, either you need to have Domino's or Chick-fil-A sandwiches to keep the crew happy. Mm-hmm. Because if they're not fed right, they're going to be like tired. Mm. And, you know, that's the two easiest good things you can have. Mm. So I remember working on an offshore boat that we caught a lot of sailfish and blue marlin and, you know, king mackerel and all that stuff. And the guy who owned the boat was like, man, you're in charge of the day before. I want you to go order one large pizza and buy 10 Chick-fil-A sandwiches. And it's like, if people forget their food, if the captain gets hungry, if the mates get hungry, like, that's the easiest food ever. And then, you know, if you bring it home, someone's going to eat it.
Oh, yeah. I'm ravenous on a boat, too. I get hungry out there. Some people are like the opposite. You know, my dad just barely like eats like a bird out there, and I eat like my body is saying, you know, it's going into like fight or flight survival mode. Like, you know, and the further I get from the shore, the more hungry I get.
So. Yeah, that's how I am. It's funny. Like, if I'm pulling the boat all day, I'll pull a boat for 8 hours and won't eat a thing or drink a thing or anything. And I'll sit there and troll baits and just eat all day long. And like, can't be just completely ravenous. But mm-hmm. I'm so focused when I'm on the platform. Mm. People are like, hey, do you want a sandwich? Do you want like a water or whatever? I'm like, no. I'm like, get it back up there and cast.
tell me about the flood tide, because I know that's the most popular thing that you guys do.
Yeah. So it's a pretty technical fishery. You know, it's we have like a 5 to 6 foot tide swing here, which is hard for a lot of people to understand because it is really big. But then there's this strange part that the difference between a 5.5 foot tide and a 5.8 or 5.9 or 6 foot tide is the difference between the water going into the grass or not going into the grass. Hmm. So, you know, when you look over the whole ecosystem, you have all the Spartina grass. And, you know, really the Spartina grass gets 2 to 3 inches of water on a regular tide, but it's not till the flood tide comes that the redfish can really make their way up in there. And the redfish are looking for the fiddler crabs. And, you know, you get the 5.8 to 6 foot plus tides. Those fish can start getting up into the grass and then, they start tailing. And that's kind of like the iconic, mm-hmm. you know, shot in Charleston or this part of the coast.
Yeah.
It's an amazing fishery. It's the fishery that people fall in love with. It's a fishery that I know people that have flats boats and, you know, call themselves fly fishing people for redfish, and that's all they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the only thing, and it only comes around the full moons and the new moons. And, you know, only a couple times a month, and it's only during about, let's say, May to the end of October. But yeah, it's super cool. The shots for a tailing redfish are much different than like a shot on a tailing bonefish or like a tailing permit. Like a tailing bonefish is going to tail into current. So it's going to tail into current, and it's going to tail in the same depth of water, where the tailing redfish we have, you can throw to him and he might just decide, oh, he's going to go right or left or do a circle or go back and then go forward. So there, it's very random. It's very hard to guide. It's very hard, not hard to fish, but it's hard to get them to figure out like exactly what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, it's very cool.
Yeah, the first time I fished it, and I had told you this earlier, but like the first time I fished it, you know, conceptually I understood that the tide was really big and how the tide would come in, and I understood how it all worked. But like when you see that much water moving in that period of time, that's not much different than a normal tide movement. It's a pretty cool thing. And then also when it's time to leave, it's definitely something that you could see that going wrong really quick. Do you have any funny stories of being out there and either yourself or just seeing some, qualified captain, if you've ever followed that account, the qualified captain moment of getting stuck out there when the water flushes out?
So I've always had like dedicated flood tide boats. So I've had like Ginus, like I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had like Ginus, and I've had a Harry Spear, super custom, super light boat. That was my go-to. Those were kind of like my fun boats to go do this tide on because it's so fun. And I never had a problem with those boats. Like, you know, the Harry Spear Glades X I had, like if I got stuck there, I could just walk it. it was 17 and a half feet and it was 60 inches wide, or, you know, 68 inches wide. But I mean, but yeah, you definitely see people, the Intercoastal Waterway has, shell banks on each side, and people forget about the shell banks. So they'll start looking around and they'll come into a creek and think they can get out of that creek, and then they can't. So yeah, I've definitely driven around the marsh over the last, 15 years or whatever, and after a good flood tide, seen people that did not make the right decision.
That's a kind way to put it. That's what I would say if I got stuck with whoever I was fishing with. I did not make the right decision.
I did not make the right decision. Yeah. Yeah. That's tough. The flood tide has also, after a big tide for us, cause our tides fluctuate so much. I mean, a regular tide for us can be 5.5 feet. We can have things up to 7.5 feet without really having a flooding event. And, so what'll happen is you'll see people who have these like 20 or 30, 34 foot, 42 foot center consoles, and they won't lift their, jet dock all the way up or their whatever dock all the way up, because they haven't been used to these big tides. And then they'll just come pick one of those boats up and all of a sudden it's gone.
Yeah. Now, how does the law work there? If a boat is just, a stray boat, finders keepers.
I wish I knew.
No, I'm kidding. Obviously it's not fine.
I know there was a buddy of mine who had like a 36 regulator in the marsh for like, he had to wait for the next big flood tide to get it.
Wow.
And there was a whole family of raccoons living in it.
Oh my gosh. eating Chick-fil-A sandwiches and Domino pizza.
Eating all of his Chick-fil-A sandwiches and all of his Bud Lights.
Oh yeah.
From his last offshore fishing trip.
That would be a hilarious photo too, by the way. Like a photo of a nice boat with just a bunch of raccoons hanging out in it, like just making it their home.
Yeah, and speaking of the raccoons, I know that Paul incorporates them in his art a lot. Which I think is just hilarious. He calls it the surf and turf, and they're all over our marsh. So you'll be pulling a low tide creek and it's no problem to just come around and see a family of raccoons that really don't care you're there, which is really weird because anywhere else, they freak out.
Now, what flies do they prefer? Like, do you have any trash flies?
Oh man. If I hooked a raccoon, I would cut him off. I wouldn't.
Yeah.
I would never want to touch one of those things.
Yeah. No, they're freaky. Well, if it's okay with you, I'd love to transition into some rapid fire questions because I could sit around and talk about this all day. But I definitely want to get into some rapid fire questions if that's cool with you.
Knives, machetes, saws, and shears, multi-tools, shovels, swords, axes, spears, hatchets, and tomahawks. If it cuts, snips, slices, or chops, Midway USA has it. Find great gift ideas in our huge selection of pocket knives and other everyday carry folding knives. Make a statement or create a family legacy with one of our top-of-the-line hunting knives. We've got a great selection of manual and electric sharpeners, too. For just about everything for the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
Shoot.
So one of the things that Charleston is known for, and I talked to Paul, and he gave me a recipe about what he called smoked okra. And one of my sponsors is Traeger, and I work on collecting some recipes for them and everything. I'd love to know, like, what? Well, give me some good Charleston food. It doesn't have to be barbecue, and if you have any recipes you could share, I'd love just to hear, get a good dish out of this.
Yeah, man. I have to immediately plug John Lewis Barbecue. It's from Austin, but it's in Charleston. So technically it's part of the Charleston, food scene.
Mm-hmm.
I have to plug them because it's family. And then, after I make that chill, my wife and I love eating grouper and triggerfish. Mm. I love it. It's sustainable. When I was a kid, and we offshore fished a lot, we used to throw triggerfish back, you know? And triggerfish is awesome. Triggerfish is sustainable.
Give me a good... How do you like to cook it? What's the triggerfish recipe? We have plenty here.
Oh, man. Old Bay. And then instead of working hard for the garlic, like I don't ever want to make my own garlic. You have to buy the garlic that comes in the toothpaste tube.
Mm-hmm.
And then you buy the same thing in the toothpaste tube that is the Italian dressing. You put that on there.
Mm-hmm.
And then oven or plancha on the grill. And that's it. But for me, it takes a triggerfish so much less time to get to maturity, sexual maturity, than a grouper or a... I don't think that red snapper are endangered, but I think triggerfish are a much more sustainable... wonderful fish than a grouper is.
Mm-hmm.
And sustainability is like huge for us right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I could go off on a whole lot of sustainability stuff, but I'm going to spare you that.
Yeah. And just we'll leave it with try putting some toothpaste style garlic on there, some Old Bay.
It's key to get the toothpaste style garlic because then you don't have to sit there. And then if you do the garlic yourself, then your hands smell like the garlic. And then your wife won't touch you later.
Yep.
And the rest of your day is pretty much just shot.
Yeah. See, now that's the types of tips that people tune in for right there.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
That's
good. The toothpaste garlic.
Another question I have, and this is a new one, but I thought it would be fun, is if you had to describe Charleston in one word, what word?
Oh, man. Charleston is love to death.
Love to death with hyphens.
Yes, one word, love to death.
Yeah, and that it seems to me like there's a great community there. And something that you had mentioned earlier when we were talking was, you got to have a good support system. And you talked about when you were guiding originally that you had a friend who had low country guide shop, and you know how that helped you out. Talk to me about the significance of local businesses, local fly shops, and how those play into the life of a fishery, a city, a guide.
So I have like a pretty interesting insight in this because my family owns two fly shops in North Carolina. The Brookings Fly Shops and Highlands and Cashers. So Scotty opened the Low Country Fly Shop and it was awesome and it was super grassroots. Everybody loved it. It was like, but it was more of a boys club than it was amazing. It's what sparked, and I think what kind of maintained the fly fishing culture here in Charleston. Like I don't think without Scotty and without that fly shop, there would be as many people fly fishing, or it would be as popular here. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Charleston as I hate to be negative, but when you said the first thing that pops in your head, love to death, it's love to death. Rent goes way up. He didn't do the rent. Just it closed down for whatever reason. Mike Abel at Hadrill's Point, they got two shops. Mike's dad opened those shops a long, 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 long time ago. He's got a little fly shop attached to his big regular tackle shop.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, if I can just tell anyone listening one thing, buy local, buy from your fly shop, buy from your bait shop. I don't care if you don't like the guys working there. You know, buy from them. They need you. Local businesses need you. And I try not to get too intense about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But if I don't have a place to go get mud minnows in the morning, your trip that morning with your family isn't going to be as much fun, because I'm not going to always be able to get bait. And the way that things are going, all of Charleston used to have 9-10 big tackle shops, and now there's 2.
Yeah. Wow. And yeah, and you know, we have one not too far from where I live called Wilkinson Fly Fishing, and it's owned by Bob Wilkinson, an incredible guy, and he has that shop built into his house, and they do fly tying nights, and they have a community that's built with it. And I know most shops are like that. We have another one near Tallahassee called Cape Harbor. We have some great fly shops around here. Forgotten Coast over in Apalachicola. I mean, the Forgotten Coast Fly Company. One of the things that I love about these fly shops is, you know, people complain all the time. Culture, culture, culture. People don't know boat etiquette. People don't, you know, where are they going to learn it? Well, a great place for people to learn it is these fly shops, because whether you like it or not, people are going to fish. And these become great places to develop communities where individuals are respectful. They know the etiquette. They know. And so rather than being negative and taking somebody in your community and running them out of business, you can support a business. And really, in a way, you're investing in the future. So I agree with that completely. You know, rent going up, it's a struggle, and that's even more reason just to try to support those shops in any way that you can. And, you know, buy a shirt, buy some materials, you know.
Yeah, don't buy it online. Go there and buy it. The other thing is that those guys, people don't realize, you would walk in there and say, what's the fly pattern, or even I want to book a trip, who's the guide I'm going to go with? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think, you know, and then they would say, oh, well, go with Jake, or go with Michael, or go with Patrick, or, you know, now it's like, there, you know, you could fish with anyone that says fly fishing on their website. But, you know, if you look at like, Florida Keys Outfitters, or, you know, like any of those shops down in South Florida, those are the guys that when someone says, I've called 3 other people and they're booked, I'm like, well, dude, these guys aren't going to send you to somebody who's not a fly fisherman. Like, if there's a fly shop in your area, a dedicated fly shop, they're going to have the good fly guides.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's hard to find.
Yeah. Well, they're putting their stamp on it, and they're putting their reputation out there. And, you know, it's a good stamp of approval if you go into a new city or you're trying to find, you know, one of the ways that I get guests for this show is I talk to people that I know and trust, and then they lead me to somebody, and they lead me to somebody. And, you know, I can only do so many of these podcasts a year. I'd love to do more, but I can only do so many. And that's one of the ways that I like to try to figure out, like, who's serious. And, you know, this might be a stretch here. You can tell me if it's a stretch. But, you know, we were talking about using, you know, bay boats and just being able to fish live bait, or be able to, there's a whole, following a whole ecosystem, a whole pattern of fish. You know, there's an ecosystem to the fishing community, and, you know, there's, and this is definitely a stretch, but hopefully there's a point in it. And, you know, well, young juvenile fishers are going to start in these shops. And, you know, it's a great opportunity, rather than being snobby, to meet them and to invest in them. Don't tell them where to go. Let them figure stuff out on their own. Let them see if they really want to do it. But rather than, you know, turning your nose up to them, you know, you can take some of these guys under your wing to a little bit, teach them how to do it the right way. And to me, I think that pays more dividends in the end. And it's a correlation to even the way that our water ecosystem works. It's an ecosystem with the fisher men and women in general. So that's, you know, I knew that your family owned too. I thought you'd have some insight, and especially in cities like Charleston, how hopefully people will try to support local businesses, from restaurants to marinas to, you know, all of that. What's the non-barbecue, what's your favorite restaurant in Charleston?
There's a very small place in Isle of Palms, which is outside of downtown, you know, the marina I work at called Cota de Peche, which is actually on the beach in Isle of Palms. And it's, you know, C-O-D-A. I believe it's Italian. Well, it is Italian, the cuisine. But that's my favorite restaurant in all of Charleston. And it's insane. It's so good.
When I come up, I'm definitely doing that because I love
Italian. It's like the closest thing to actually being in Italy. They have like, yeah, it's nutty. You have like the squid ink pasta and the meat Frito Misto, the all the stuff that, you know, is real Italian. And it's in this like little hole in the wall right on Front Beach that nobody even knows about. And it's my favorite hole in the wall. But yeah, other than that, downtown, I haven't been out downtown too much. In Daco is a place that people like to go a lot.
Paul dropped some good downtown ones.
Paul's office is downtown, and he lives on the other side of downtown than I do, and he's down there a lot. Like, I live out on Sullivan's Island, so I'm like a good 20 minutes from downtown Charleston. So there's High Time on Sullivan's Island and The Obstinate Daughter, which I think both of them are like, you know, pretty fancy. They've been written up a lot, and specifically Obstinate Daughter, if you want to go there, you got to call like 5 weeks or 5 months ahead.
Wow.
It's crazy in June and July. Yeah, they got written up by somebody and it popped off.
Jeez, man. My next one is, and I love asking this question, if you could go back to yourself when you were 13, 14 years old and you're throwing the fly rod, not many people around you are throwing the fly rod, and you could give yourself some advice, knowing what you know today, what advice would you give yourself?
Man, I'm not sure I would do anything different because I was like, I enjoyed it a lot. I was hammering it. I didn't fish regular gear. Like, I just threw the fly rod. And to me, it wasn't a, like, now people say like, oh, well, like, you know, fly or die, or, you know, I won't, you know, it doesn't count unless it's on fly. And for me, it was just my preferred method of fishing. So it wasn't like a thing where I proved it to anyone, or there was no one else around. The only thing I would have changed would have been to, you know, spend more time in the salt, because when we were in the salt, the only time I ever, did the fly in the salt was when I had the opportunity and the people that were around me understood I had the capabilities. And, you know, it wasn't because you know, they didn't expect a 13-year-old walking on their boat with a 10 weight. They were kind of like, well, let's catch a few fish on gear first and then see if the bite's good. And I at the time I should have just been like, well, here, watch me lay down some line. And then they would have, if that was me as a guide and I had, you know, I had a 12-year-old walk on the boat and I'm going to go jack crevalle fishing or tarpon fishing or whatever, and this kid brings this, you know, tumble fork outfit or 10 weight, I'm like, oh, okay, dude. You know, I would have been more assertive on some of the stuff I'd been.
My last question is, you know, you have three kids now. You have, you know, you're running a business that has a lot of multifaceted approaches that you can do, plugged into the community. For you, when you think about long-term, you know, future, what does success look like for you?
Wow. Man, success for me looks like conservation. Like, I want my girls to be able to have the same ecosystem to play around in and to enjoy that and see the same birds and you know, see all that stuff that I saw. And that would be success for me, because I just wanted to see them be able to experience the same things. Like, if down the road the Roseate Spoonbill or, you know, the whatever else, like, wasn't coming to South Carolina anymore, or the tarpon weren't coming, or the Jack Crevalle weren't coming, or the billfish had, you know, we've already lost our tuna, which is, you know, terrible. You know, really, I think conservation and getting other people involved in conservation and having our ecosystem being as healthy and productive now as when my children are my age, that would be a huge success for me.
Mm. And I guess I got a follow up to that. I thought that was a great answer. What do you feel like is the most important thing, the key to trying to see generations live that out and to embody that as well?
I like to say that it's just telling them about it, and it's like a like me and you thing. Like I'm sure that you don't like plastic, like I don't like plastic, and I'm sure you recycle without knowing you really personally. But really it comes down to a reform and change in the way that we create energy.
Mm-hmm.
Fossil fuels, and change the you know, the pH of the ocean, and plastics are the two
mm-hmm.
main things. And then if we're not reliant on fossil fuels, we're not reliant on you know, offshore drilling. And then you kind of have this like kind of trifecta of, if we're not reliant on oil, then the oceans are healthier.
Mm.
So that's kind of my take on it. Yeah. I know it's not perfect, and I know that there's a lot of people that disagree, but
there's so many different things that people say. It's hard, it's overwhelming, it's hard, it's heartbreaking for me to even try to keep up with all of it. But, you know, back to that book, The Last Kid in the Woods, or The Last Child in the Woods, he was talking about how today kids know about all of these environmental issues without knowing about, like, having firsthand experience in environments. And he was saying when he was a kid, he didn't know about deforestation, but he knew about the forest behind his house. And now we have kids who, they know all these things, but they don't have that personal connection. And I think that ties full circle to taking your kid out on a walk to look for shark teeth on a camping trip, or to, you know, go on a boat ride, and to make them fall in love first with what we're trying to protect. Because I think that becomes an issue with voting. You know, it's hard, you know, all these captains and guides, they want to see, you know, Captains for Clean Water down here is doing a great job. We want to see people join the fight, but if they don't share the love, they're not going to join the fight. And I think that, you know, it's a multiple approach, but you're doing a great job with that. And thanks for hanging out with us today and sharing, and I'll make sure to include some links so that people can follow you on the blog post.
Yeah, man, I'll make sure you get those. And I've really enjoyed talking to you today, and thanks for all the time, and thanks for talking to the bros in Charleston. We like sharing our ecosystem with the guys down in Florida.
Absolutely, man. And I was supposed to be in person, and and I'm glad that we were able to make this happen. Hey, Jake, thanks, man.
Hunter, I appreciate it, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks again for listening to the Captain's Collective. Please help us out by leaving a review on iTunes and sharing this podcast. We hope that you enjoy. This is the Captain's Collective.
On Mondays, head offshore with Captain Scott Walker and Steve Roger for breathtaking deep sea adventures.
Coming to me.
Double. He's jumping.
Oh!
Look at that belly.
Don't miss Mondays with Into the Blue, brought to you by Academy Sports and Outdoors from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern.
Tell a few fish stories along the way.
On Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment. Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern. Presented by Abyss Battery, Waypoint TV.